Everyone knows if you want to innovate, you have to take huge risks, right? Right? Well, actually, today's guest says that innovation is more often the result of big little breakthroughs. Josh Linkner is going to help us understand why. This episode of the Axon Creative Podcast is brought to you by Skillshare. Explore your creativity at skillshare.com/AC and get a free trial of premium membership. Well, hey friends, welcome to the Accidental Creative Podcast. My name is Todd Henry. I'm the founder of Accidental Creative. I'm also the author of a bunch of books. And this show is about you. It is about your creative process. It's about how to be prolific, brilliant, and healthy in life and in work. One of the mindset tweaks that we have to make if we want to be effective as creative professionals, meaning those who have to go to work, solve problems, make things every day, is we have to bust this myth that innovation or breakthrough ideas are always the result of big risk. It's doing something nobody's ever thought of before. We are jumping off a cliff and hoping there's ground underneath of us. That's what we often celebrate culturally. We love to tell those stories. But the reality is, most innovation is the result of a lot of little risks, a lot of little breakthroughs. And that's not just true in businesses. It's also true in our own lives. Often, personal breakthroughs are the result of small cumulative actions, not huge risks, right? Whether it's personal health, mental health, our own development, our own study, our own skill development, all of those things are the result of little actions. Today's guest is Josh Linkner. He is going to help us understand how this works and some ways that we can start thinking in new ways about our work to help us experience those big little breakthroughs more consistently. Before we dive into the interview, I want to let you know today's episode is brought to you by Skillshare. So Skillshare is an online learning community that offers membership with meaning, with so many topics to explore, so much to explore, real projects to create, and the support of fellow creatives. Skillshare empowers you to accomplish real growth. You can witness your own transformation as you turn small steps into giant leaps, just like we're talking about on this episode. Skillshare makes it possible. So today we're talking about big little breakthroughs, right? We're talking about small steps that lead to big results. Well, one of the things I've discovered is that often big ideas come from the small action of everyday writing. Maybe that's something you want to get better at. Maybe you want to become a better writer, because writing, quite frankly, is, I believe, one of the most important skills you can develop as a professional today, because so much communication is done via writing. Well, Skillshare has any number of classes to help you develop your writing. For example, creative personal writing, write the real you, or maybe storytelling 101, character, conflict, context, and craft, creative writing for all, a 10-day journaling challenge, or creative nonfiction, write truth with style. That's something we all have to do, whether we're writing marketing copy or writing an email to our manager, right? We all have to be able to write the truth with style. Skillshare will help you develop your craft. Practice makes progress. Advancing toward a goal is achievable with short lessons and hands-on projects. There's nothing better than getting better. Accomplishing growth is extremely satisfying. And by the way, Skillshare is also incredibly affordable, especially when compared to pricey in-person classes and workshops. An annual subscription is less than $10 a month. So explore your creativity at skillshare.com/AC and get a free trial of premium membership. Again, that's skillshare.com/AC. And we thank Skillshare for sponsoring this episode of the Accidental Creative Podcast.
No matter how good we are at what we do, no matter how normal the day begins, things just go wrong. Sometimes we see it coming, but most times we simply don't. I'm Frank Sapovitz, the host of When Things Go Wrong. You'll meet fascinating people who had to manage difficult problems, often under tremendous pressure. From business leaders, law enforcement pros, athletes, actors, and more, you'll hear stories of tragedy and triumph and learn how they met crisis head on. Find When Things Go Wrong on your favorite podcast app.
Well, it's so great to welcome to the show Josh Linkner. Josh is a phenomenal author. He's written so many great books. His new book is called Big Little Breakthroughs. I can't wait for this conversation. Josh, welcome to the Axon Creative Podcast.
Todd, thank you so much. What a pleasure to be with you.
So could you share, what's the big idea behind Big Little Breakthroughs? You've spent your career really focusing on innovation, creativity, helping people and organizations understand how to come up with that next big breakthrough, right? Like the nature of innovation. What's the big idea behind this book?
Yeah, so the book is called Big Little Breakthroughs, How Small Everyday Innovations Drive Oversized Results. And to a degree, it sort of flips what we normally think about innovation upside down. You know, most people think for an idea to count, it has to be a billion-dollar idea. Or most people think that only some people can be creative. Like, unless you're wearing a lab coat or a hoodie, put your head down and do what you're told. And this is the opposite. This is sort of like innovation for the rest of us. And my whole goal in writing it was to help everyday people become everyday innovators. So the notion here is the opposite. It's cultivating small micro innovations, daily little teeny acts of creativity in high frequency. And what happens is that those little things add up to big things. It's way less risky. It's way more accessible to most of us. And we're building critical skills at the same time. So if we really do want to become more innovative, organizationally or individually, it's a lower risk, more pragmatic approach to do so.
You know, this insight is something that I think people who work inside of organizations or who have worked in the innovation space kind of realize this as a reality, right? But I think you're right. To most people, they think of innovation as this giant, huge risk, this big, I'm going to put all the chips in and I'm just going to go all in and try to make something. But the reality is, even the big innovations that we encounter are the result of, as you said, like little breakthroughs that happen over time. Can you give us an example of something that we all would probably think of as a huge all-in innovation that actually was the result of a lot of small bets over time?
Sure. You're exactly right. Because when the pressure is on, like my idea better be, you know, all encompassing and perfect and change the world. And you weigh that against the risk. It's just easy to gravitate to doing nothing. Mm-hmm. And so when we take these smaller approaches, little attempts, it's much more palatable. But yeah, so in the book, I cover stories of people all over the world. I actually spent over 1,000 hours researching and doing interviews with CEOs and billionaires and celebrity entrepreneurs and Grammy award-winning musicians, but lots of everyday people, which I actually found much more interesting. So I don't cover the story of Apple or Netflix because no kidding, we already know they're innovative, but what about normal people? And one that comes to mind to answer your question is a guy who I interviewed named Trevin Resterich. So you and I probably have never heard of him. I didn't ever hear of him until I got to know him a bit, but he is not a celebrity. He's not a billionaire. He's a normal dude. He doesn't wear a big fancy suit. He wears like crinkly khaki pants and 10-year-old loafers. But Trevin is in London, and he was telling me that the single biggest environmental crisis in London, central London, is cigarette butt litter. So I'm sure you've seen that. You're in a beautiful city, but you look down and there's all the cigarette litter, which is terrible for the environment. It looks bad. It's bad for small animals that ingest it. Cities spend millions of dollars to clean it up, to no success. So Trevin cared about the environment. But again, he's not a big shot. He just said, maybe I could do something about it. So he invented something called the ballot bin. So Todd, imagine that you and I were having a fish and chips in a London pub and maybe we finished our pint and we walk out on the street and we're about to throw our cigarette butts on the ground. But instead we see this glowing yellow box and it catches your attention. So we walk a little closer and it's a metal yellow box mounted at eye level on a pole. The front is glass, and it asks at the top a two-part question, like, which is your favorite food, pizza or hamburgers? And underneath each, there's a little receptacle where smokers are encouraged to vote with their butts. So I stick my little cigarette butt under pizza, and I see it fall on top of the other cigarette butts that voted for pizza. And it's sort of like you have two real-time bar charts right there to see who's winning the war. And here's Brilliant. The thing. It was low-tech. It didn't require millions of dollars. It didn't require 6 PhDs. It didn't require regulatory approval, but it worked. And in fact, when ballot bins are installed, they reduce cigarette litter by up to 80%. So Trevin went on to start a company, and he's got like 55 employees, and these ballot bins are now installed in 27 countries, making a real dent in this serious problem. So the reason I wanted to share that, Todd, is like when we see Elon Musk, we say, cool for him, good that he's so innovative, but it's hard to see ourselves in that. But when I see Trevin Resterich and his ballot bin and I say, you know what, I could have done that. You could have done that. We all could do that. And to me, it's so much more encouraging and accessible, showing that we all, as human beings, can exhibit some creativity to drive better outcomes in the things that we care about the most.
That is such a great example of someone who just encountered a problem and said, wait a minute, I can do something about that, right? And the reality is we all, every day, we all have to solve problems. We all encounter situations where we are equipped to be able to handle something. But to your point, I think we think, well, you know, that's somebody else's problem. That's somebody else's issue. How do we, you know, in that, in those circumstances, like how do we spot the idea that we should work on, right? I think that's always something people really wrestle with is, well, what if I choose the wrong problem? Or what if I choose something that isn't going to pan out? You know, how do we know which idea we should actually work on at any given time?
Well, by the way, I love the title of, you know, accidental creative. And when I was talking to Trowin, he said, I said, wow, you're so creative. He's like, me? I didn't take art class. I wasn't good at dance. And it's really kind of breaks my heart that you have such wildly amazing creative people in the world that don't even view themselves as creative. But the answer to your question anyway is, you know, how do you know which one to double down on? Here's the thing. If we think about creativity as these all or nothing giant swing for the fences bets, we better be right or else like the world's going to end.
Yeah.
Don't do that. That's irresponsibly risky. I think what we want to do is de-risk the process by taking high frequency of smaller bets, big little breakthroughs. And I think that what we should do as leaders or individuals on an ongoing basis is think about running lots of concurrent small experiments, prototypes. Fixed time, fixed money, as cheap and crude as you can make it. So instead of you having an idea saying, okay, I have a business, here's my new idea, I better roll it out, wide sweeping global change and hope for the best, don't do that. Instead, what you might want to do is say, okay, I have five ideas, how can I test them each as cheaply and quickly as possible? And the ones that don't work, discard them quickly. The ones that do, double the size of the experiment. So when you take that approach, it actually de-risks the creative process dramatically. You don't have to be right. You just have to run a lot of experiments. And one thing that I write in the book is a little tip is that many of us have a to-do list. I would recommend for each of us keeping a to-test list. So in other words, instead of waiting around for the big idea that's going to be perfect upon launch, which let's face it, very, very few are, cultivating lots of ideas. Some may be goofy, some may be cool, whatever. Don't even judge them. Just keep a list. And then when you're trying to go after something, maybe you take a look at the list and say, okay, which of these three or four ideas can I test in a really cheap way? And that approach to innovation is so much more easy and accessible and risk-free versus these wild swing for the fences, high-risk bets.
Yeah. You know, one of the things, sometimes I think comfort and familiarity become the enemies of innovation, right? And one of the things this past year has done, to your point, for me, is it's forced me to have to think about my business in a new way. I mean, probably a lot like you, I spend most of my time on the road speaking to groups of people or working with companies. And boy, a lot of that just sort of vanished overnight when they said, you know what, we're not going to have big crowds in a room anymore. You know, just boom, gone instantly. And the interesting thing is it really sort of, I think it's been a huge gift, even though it was really hard, right? To have this thing that you kind of work on just kind of vanish overnight, but to have to find new ways of accomplishing the same purpose, to have to innovate, sort of be forced to rethink things. You know, when you talk about you're having these little experiments, I mean, I've got like probably five or six little experiments going right now, different like little products that I'm creating with beta groups and kind of trying to test things and figure out. And I hadn't really thought about it as a formal process, but really I sort of accidentally stumbled into exactly what you're talking about, which is this sort of like have a bunch of little tests going at the same time. And then whichever one takes off, great, put resources into that and fly with it, right?
That's exactly right. And by the way, the optimal number of failed experiments is not zero. If you have zero failed experiments, you're not pushing or trying hard enough, you know? And so companies like Microsoft and Google, they have 50, 60% failure rates to their experiments, and they seem to do just fine. But when you think about, you know, creativity, and you and I both are passionate about this, I feel like it's often this mythical, misunderstood, squishy topic, as if, you know, you can have processes for how you mow the lawn, but you can't have a process for creativity. And I believe you can harness and deploy it as a manageable resource in the same way that you figure out how to mow the lawn. And by the way, think about how many discoveries happen. Thank God we now have a COVID vaccine. Here's how it didn't happen. There wasn't some dude in a corner office saying, "Eureka, I've got it. I've got a great idea. Go print a billion doses." Like they locked that person up. What happened is there was a lot of people in a diligent, thoughtful way in a laboratory testing hundreds or thousands of things. And I'm sure none of them were right on the first time. But one or two of them looked like a little bit, they showed some promise, they tinkered with it, they explored, and over time, they were able to marshal it down the field and reach a discovery point, an innovation. And that's how we should look at innovation, not just for stuff, but for processes and procedures and systems as well. By the way, you mentioned COVID. I mean, first of all, to be clear, this was not a pleasant thing for anybody.
Right.
And I know that took, you know, massive economic toll and health toll, and for which I have great compassion. Yes. But I also think that the upside is that the world has hit a giant reset button and the patterns of the past have been broken. And there's an old saying that when patterns are broken, new worlds emerge. And so the way we shop and lead and interact and buy and love and eat, it's all changed. Therein lies the opportunity to reimagine and rethink it. And sometimes those forced situations, while uncomfortable, to be clear, can really yield terrific outcomes because, again, it's challenging us that we must do something different.
Yeah. All right. I want to talk about what those listening can do to become an everyday innovator. And I want to kind of maybe just do a rapid fire. There are eight, you call them the eight obsessions of everyday innovators. And I would love to just kind of throw these out to you because some of these are really unique. I've never heard them described this way. And just kind of have you give a brief description of what this is and how we might be able to apply this. So the first one is fall in love with the problem.
Yeah, just setting the stage. So the book, we there's a lot of academic research and stuff, neuroscience research that supports the point. But I really try to lay out what are the mindsets, habits, and tactics that everyday people can deploy to drive creativity. Again, to think about it as a manageable resource. And so what you're talking about are the mindsets. So as you're right, there are eight core mindsets of everyday innovators. I call them the eight obsessions. And most of them are counterintuitive. But they are, and by the way, they don't take years of study or millions of dollars. You can apply them very quickly. They're just little shifts that we can deploy. And of course, each of them are backed with stories and tactics and research and such. But to answer your question, so the first one that you brought up was called fall in love with the problem. We're all solution oriented. We want to solve the problem as quick as possible. So when we see a problem, we often leap to the first answer and then become fixated on it. So you were like first and fixated. And that may not be the best answer. But because we then put on our tunnel vision blinders, we're unwilling to consider anything else. And so this principle, fall in love with the problem rather than your solution, is the notion of really connecting what's the real problem that you're trying to solve. And before prematurely solving it, really study the problem, bathe in the problem, look at it from different lenses, and having keeping open-minded that even if you find a solution that may show promise, if you find a better one, you don't care. You don't mind discarding your solution because what you care about the most is solving the problem in the best possible way. Mm. And that notion of really deeply connecting to the problem, asking tons of questions, getting super curious about it, is actually a more effective approach than, again, prematurely selecting your solution and then having sort of doggedness, just being overly committed to one particular way of solving it.
Yeah. Okay. How about number two, which is start before you're ready?
Yeah. So most of us wait. We wait for permission. We wait for a directive. We wait until our game plan is perfect. And the risk of this is that we wait so long we miss the opportunity or don't start at all. Start before you're ready is the notion of getting started, whether it's an opportunity or a problem that you're trying to tackle. Getting started, even knowing full well that you don't have all the answers, knowing full well that your first attempts are going to be messy and probably look goofy, but you get started and you find your way. So it's the notion of willing to be able to course correct and pivot and adapt and be agile as you proceed, but getting going quickly. One of the people that I interviewed in the book is a guy named Matt Ishbia. Matt is 40 years old and he's currently worth $12 billion. Most people don't know of him. He's not a household name. But Matt told me, I thought he said it really well. He said, let's imagine this. Let's say we both saw an opportunity at the same time. And we both saw it, so we haven't figured it out. But let's say I get started today and you wait 6 months till you have it figured out perfect. You've lined up all your resources. He goes, here's what's going to happen. Day one, my first attempt is going to look ridiculous. And day two, it's still going to be terrible, but it's going to be a little bit better. And day three, I'm going to learn something and be a little bit better. And here's the deal, Josh. He said, by the time you get to month six and you launch yours with what you think is perfect, I've already had 100 cycles of revisions going into it. And so I'm going to be so much further ahead than you. He goes, look, even if you're smarter than me and have more resources, because I started quickly and I used those cycles accordingly and I adapted quickly, I'm just going to be further ahead. And he's exactly right. So that principle, again, start before you're ready.
Love that. All right. I want to skip a couple here. Use every drop of toothpaste. I actually chuckled when I read this. Could you describe to us what that principle is, what that mindset is?
Yeah. You and I, again, we help leaders and individuals cultivate creativity. And I'm sure you hear this too. The thing you often hear the most is, I'd love to be more innovative, but, and then like, wait for it. And they say, I don't have enough. And there's always a fill in the blank. I don't have enough money. I don't have enough time. I don't have enough bandwidth. I don't have enough people. And I always playfully respond that, look, if the amount of external resources that you had equaled your level of creativity, the federal government would be the most creative organization on the planet and startups would be the least. Right. And we know the exact opposite is true. So the principle, use every drop of toothpaste, is around being scrappy and resourceful. It's around doing more with less and letting your creativity, internal resources, fill in for any gaps of external resources that you might find. you know, one of the things that I talked about in the book, I don't really talk much about myself in the book, but I did share a personal experience. I put myself through college playing music. I'm a jazz guitarist. I've been playing for 40 plus years. Love the art form. Anyway, I was studying music in college, and I had a professor that would force me to remove strings from the instrument. So he would literally make me take off one, two, sometimes three strings from the guitar. You figure if your resources are cut in half, your creativity is going to tank. But the surprising and counterintuitive thing happened. When those strings were off, I could no longer rely on the patterns that I knew. And I was forced to solve musical problems in a really fresh way. So actually my creativity accelerated rather than tanked. So sometimes being resource constrained actually can play to our benefit. And that's what using every drop of toothpaste is all about.
I love that. All right. I want to ask you about one more. By the way, I didn't know that we share that music. I also put myself through school playing music. We'll have to talk about that offline at some point. Don't forget the dinner mint.
So when I talk to people around the world, maybe you see this too, and I say, ask about, you know, competitive advantage and such, people often share competence. So they share, oh, I have great service, or I deliver good value, or my quality is high. And those are important things, to be clear. I'm not being dismissive of that, but competence is not a competitive advantage. And so to me, that's just the ante to play. Don't forget the dinner mint is the notion of this. I'm sure, Todd, you've been to a nice restaurant, and at the end of the meal, someone says, oh, Mr. Henry, you know, here's a little something, compliments of the chef. And if you ordered that, it would be good. But because it was a surprise and delight, you weren't expecting it, it becomes otherworldly. Yeah. So the strategy, don't forget the dinner mint, is how innovators think, okay, once I've achieved competence, is there a little something extra? Can I add a little extra creative flourish to plus up what I'm delivering, whether it's an internal email or an external product or anywhere in between? And so the notion is, again, looking for little ways to just add a little extra something, some creative surprise and delight to completely stand out from the competitive set. You know, one quick example of that, lovely woman named Melissa Tabbs. Melissa was born and her family grew up in Italy, and they were ice cream makers. They made like handmade gelato and such. So she comes to New York and she wants to continue in the ice cream business. But how do you possibly compete selling ice cream in New York City? There's like thousands of competitors. You're selling a commodity. Good luck. So she realized that she had to come up with this dinner mint strategy. Just having good ice cream wasn't enough. So she did some experimenting, and what else could she add? What's a small extra something that she could add? And she did. She added alcohol. And so her brand is called Tipsy Scoop booze-infused ice cream. And what it is there's like chocolate limoncello sorbet, and there's cake batter vodka martini, and there's margarita-flavored ice cream. And so she does. They're booze-infused ice cream. But now keep in mind, when you look at her overall cost structure, it's way less than 5%. She still has the same real estate and marketing and labor costs and insurance and refrigeration and all that. But this little extra something made her stand out. Today, in this crowded commodity field, she has two wildly successful retail stores. She ships her ice cream to all 50 states. She has a cookbook. She does corporate catering. She has like a YouTube thing. So she's this wildly successful person in a commodity business, not because she only makes good ice cream. It's because she has this don't forget the dinner mint strategy. She adds a little bit of something extra to make her efforts stand out.
Love that. I had a great conversation with Phil Libin, who was the co-founder of Evernote and now has a company All Turtles. And he was saying that they have shunned the idea of minimum viable product, which, you know, is a very useful construct for sure. But he said the way that they discuss it is they try to create a minimum awesome product, which I thought was great. Like, what is the minimum like awesome product we can make where it's still rudimentary, but somebody looks at it and goes, that's awesome, right? And it sounds like that's kind of what you're talking about. You know, it's that little thing you add that makes people go, wow, that's pretty cool. It's not there yet, but it's really cool.
That's awesome that he said that. Funny that you say that, because I've been involved in a lot of startups, and I always went with the phrase so MVP, minimum viable product. Mine was always it was basically MFVP, which is like minimum effing viable. It's got to be great, or, you know, that minimum, yeah. Like no one wants a minimum anything.
Right.
But anyway, real quickly, and there was another a high-end restaurant now in New York. I guess I'm hungry today, but there was a super high-end five-star Michelin restaurant, and they have something pretty cool. They take 5% of their resources and devote it to a team of called dream weavers who research their guests and look for cues. And their job isn't to like serve or make the food. They just deliver these crazy over the top experiences periodically. Like one family was in town and with their young children and they were seeing snow falling out the window for the first time. A server overhears this, reports it to these dream weavers who then run around and procure sleds and a limousine, which is waiting for this family unexpectedly when they leave. And they're whisked off to an evening of sledding in Central Park. And so they have something that's really cool. They call it the 95-5 doctrine. Here's what they say. I think I'm quoting pretty close. They say, you know, we spend 95% of our resources with Terminator-like efficiency. We tighten the screws. We're super efficient. We're you know, accountable, all this stuff, such that we can take 5% of our resources, and they say, we in quotes, and invest them foolishly. And the whole key is that it's not foolish at all. You know, the fact that they reinvest this 5% in over-the-top unexpected client delight drives their business through the roof. And that's one of the, why 11 Madison Park is one of the most recognized restaurants in the world.
That's wonderful. I absolutely love that ethic. The book is called Big Little Breakthroughs. It's fantastic. Josh, if people want to learn more about you and about your work, where can they go?
Thanks, man. Yeah, I think I would recommend checking out biglittlebreakthroughs.com. You certainly can buy the book or the audiobook or whatever if you want, but even if you don't, there's a ton of free resources there to get you started. There's a free creativity assessment tool. There's a quick start guide. There's a bunch of downloadable worksheets. So just think of that as your free toolkit that's yours for the taking. It's at biglittlebreakthroughs.com. And if you want to check out me, I'm just joshlinkner.com, and my social handles on all channels are just at Josh Linkner, L-I-N-K-N-E-R.
Wonderful. Well, Josh, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
I appreciate all the great work that you do as well. Thank you.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. AC Premium subscribers, stick around after the music. I have a few personal takeaways I want to share with you. If you're not an AC Premium subscriber, you can check it out at acpremium.me. Also, if you enjoyed this episode and you're not following the show, you can do so anywhere you listen to podcasts or at accidentalcreative.com. This podcast is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to many other fine shows. Remember, friends, cover bands don't change the world. Don't be a cover band. You need to find your unique voice if you want to thrive. We'll see you next time.